Oh, yeah, the women were often the most militant because, you know, they had the hungry children that makes women militant.
On the 14th day of April of 1935, there struck the worst of dust storms.
The Militant Muse, Activist Women in the Arts During the Great Depression. Part 6 in a series of programs exploring the activities and achievements of radical women in the 1930s.
They all had children, and many of them also became radicals. And many of them are in the Workers' Alliance. I don't know if you've seen my book, The Girl, which is about them, and in fact it was written by them. Because we all, when the Depression started, thousands of women poured into the Twin Cities from the farms. And there was no relief like we know it. There was no aid to anybody. There was no surplus food. There was no stamps. There was no unemployment insurance. There was nothing, absolutely nothing.
The radio reported, we listened with alarm.
Meridel LeSueur, reporter, organizer, writer.
They had to leave the farms because the drought came and there was no food on the farms, so the older children had to leave so they could feed the younger ones. So they literally poured into Minneapolis and St. Paul from the farms, farm girls, farm women. And there wasn't even soup lines for women. There were soup lines for men, and didn't say a woman couldn't go on, but you didn't because you'd be jeered at and you'd be amongst this line of men. I mean, you just didn't ever see a woman on there. So we had to organize ourselves, and we took over a warehouse, for example, and a bunch of us lived there. And in the evening, I got them, all of us, to take down our lives. We were hungry and cold. And so the girl is actually verbatim some of the lives of the women there.
And the children, they was crying as it whistled through the cracks.
Although great art is said to be eternal, almost all art can be said to reflect its own time. In her book, The Girl, Meridel LeSueur consciously tried to portray the hopes and the tragedy of American women during the Depression. Hard times demanded that high art be just as relevant as propaganda, and the period produced an abundance of both. Radical women writers wanted to reach as rich and wide an audience as possible during the crisis. The special interest which they took in portraying other women derives at least in part from the particular difficulties which women shared in the turmoil of the decade. Myra Page Markey, trade unionist, teacher, novelist.
I've noticed, I didn't realize at the time, but each main protagonist in these three novels and the fourth one that I've done there are women. And I didn't consciously set out to do that, as far as I know, but it's from that point in the world that I partly see things. But what I did learn, what I want to make a point of here, that my experiences in the trade union movement convinced me of the potential of the ordinary, so-called everyday working people. And I think the future of the country lies there, and I've thought it for a long time.
The working class sympathy which these women express is, of course, informed by left-wing ideology. It also fits, in a literary sense, in its time. Since the beginning of the century, writers like Dreiser and Lewis had brought journalistic insight to the realist novel, thus helping to forge a powerful new tool of social criticism. Similar developments were underway in other art forms as well. Jane Dudley, dancer and choreographer.
For example, the very first solo I did, I called In the Life of a Worker. I did it while I was with Hanya Holm, and it started, and it was in what is called a rondo form. It started with a kind of rocking theme, as I remember, and then it was the worker as a farmer or an agricultural worker, working in the fields, the tiller. And then it was the industrial worker working in the factory. And then it was the worker in war, and ends with him being killed, of course. And it returned always to this interlude section. Estelle Parnas wrote the music specially for it. And I did that many times.
With 17 million jobless in 1933, the plight of the workers was of genuine concern to artists and to the public at large. Emily got involved in radical theater for lack of other work. Born into a poor Italian family, she had planned to become a teacher. When the Depression came, new teachers were not needed.
So I sort of just kind of slid into the theater. We did all kinds of plays, little skits, really. And we played at various unions, like the Steelworkers Union. We played all over the city, in all the boroughs, wherever we could. And they were skits that had political and social content, radical content. That's where I really became introduced to the radical movement, through the theater, really.
Myra traces her radicalism back to an early realization of sexual stereotyping.
The first thing that made a rebel out of me was that I had taken for granted I would be a doctor because I admired my father. I'd been with him a lot and on his work, and he talked things over with us some. You know, he just liked to talk about interesting things. And when I was 8 years old, my brother and I were riding with my father, and my brother said something about he could do most anything when he grew up. And he says, you can't do anything. You're going to get married and raise babies. And I said, oh, no, I'm going to be a doctor like Daddy. And he said, but you can't. And so then I pressed my father. I said, but I can, can't I? And he told me that many wonderful things in a life for a woman, you know, she'll have a home and children and so forth and so on. But it came out that he didn't think I should take medicine, because in the South, and I guess he only visualized the South especially, they just weren't women doctors. That was a real shock to me, because he'd always call me a chip off the old block.
Were these women actively recruited by radical groups? Emily.
No, I think it was just an individual who was part of a political movement who decided that he wanted to do his bit through through theater, but on a much more personal level, not in a theater, but on the floor of a union hall or in the floor of a meeting, rather than on a stage, using very few props. And it's agitational propaganda. That's exactly what it was. He was going to do his teaching instead of lecture form through through a dramatic form. And that was what we did for a while. I don't remember how long we did it. We did it for quite some years, and then it just died of itself because every one of us had to make a living, and it was not funded, and it took up too much time, really. And then, of course, other groups took precedence, the theater collective, and then the group theater, and so, and then I was really into the professional theater, so.
Merida recalls when her interest in the workers' struggle began.
Well, I wrote about everything that happened in the Middle West. I was a kind of a farm proletarian reporter. Well, I was, since I was about 10 years old. I wrote for New Republic and Nation and for radical papers and for labor papers. I was never an objective reporter. I don't believe in it. I mean, that's a middle-class ploy to put you outside of what's happening. So I was just part of it. I also made a small living. That was my only living. You asked me how I raised my children. Well, that was my only living, actually, was reporting. Well, I reported the drought and the New Republic. I reported for labor papers that were growing up then. CIO papers were very remarkable papers then.
Jane.
I think the person who was most important in forming my direction was the man I later married, Leo Hurwitz. It was really through Leo that I became interested in Soviet film, in left-wing poetry, in the left theater of that time. I very quickly became a part of the whole movement, which was not hard to do because there were very few people interested in the arts, young, who were working in these directions, and the audience was hungry and anxious to be entertained with the messages that they believed in, and it reinforced them, and we were, all of us who were doing things, were embraced with open arms.
Admiration for Soviet Russia ran high in intellectual circles at the time. That Myra Page's novel, Moscow Yankee, was published by the distinguished firm of George Putnam Sons shows how widespread this interest was in 1935.
Many Americans and British working people and other people who didn't have jobs went there, and also others who were curious like us to learn about the country and the people and what was going on. And there were a group of workers from Detroit, mechanics, and that's what I based my mine on. I met an engineer from mechanical engineer who was head of a department of one of the big factories. He was from Detroit. He had a pioneer sort of spirit. I don't know that he was unemployed here, but he there were many people that had contracts, you see, and he went over and he loved teaching the young people a trade. So I based one of the men characters in the book on this engineer.
Many could not go. Still, Russia was a source of inspiration.
In the 30s, when we went to big, big mass meetings at the Garden, one felt deeply, deeply moved and carried away when you heard the Comintern. And when one spoke about the Soviet Union, and reading 10 Days That Shook the World, we really believed that it would be a brave new world and that goodness and right would be the way things would be in the Soviet Union. No one would be poor. No one would be unemployed.
Here at home, where many lacked money for essentials like food and clothing, building a public was the artist's first concern. The radical political milieu, of course, offered a ready-made audience. Emily.
At union halls, at demonstrations, yes. And we did skits at Madison Square Garden, when various political parties, the leftist parties, would have their conventions, and we would do skits there. I did many skits. And we were closely associated with the Workers' Laboratory Theater, which became the Theater of Action, you know, with all those people. We went to all sorts of demonstrations, to all sorts of, when people were on strike, we would picket and we would say who we were. Sometimes we would sing. We even did little skits on the street, you know, picketing. We were in the May Day demonstrations.
History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above?
Although the radical theater at this time was striving for expressionist clarity, a la Brecht, it often settled for agitational propaganda.
Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo.
Well, agitprop was, you know, you had symbols, really. They weren't human beings in the full sense of the word. They weren't three-dimensional figures. They weren't even two. They were actually, you know, it was bad and good. It was like the everyman plays in the, you know, the earlier periods. There were the workers who were always 100% good and virtuous, and they were the bosses who were the capitalists, and they were always nasty, the landlords. They were always mean and vicious and cruel. I mean, it was that raw, that simple, that primitive, really.
I'll get a tune that will do. It will be packed with social fact.
And I will.
And eventually we became dissatisfied ourselves with just playing cymbals. So that eventually people began to write. Actually, Clifford Odets came out of this period, and he wrote some beautiful plays, as you know, for the group theater.
By mid-decade, leftist militancy was well established in the theater and in the training which performers received.
What they asked us to do really was to understand why the forces in society produced specific kinds of people, even landlords and capitalists and bosses and so on, so that if you had to play that character, you really were better equipped than somebody who was sympathetic to landlords and capitalists and so on, because we had a real three-dimensional understanding of it.
In the dance world, a similar movement was afoot. Jane.
We came, we were fervent in the kind of ideas we had and the way dances we made, and we found audiences who wanted to see what we did. It wasn't a question of doing a performance for 10 or 12, 14, 200 people. It was a question of, we finally built an audience of 3,000 who saw the New Dance League put on a benefit for New Theater Magazine, the Center Theater at the time, and it made a great, great stir. In fact, it influenced the important dancers who were the leaders of the modern dance at that period, people like Doris Humphrey and Charles Wideman and Martha Graham. They all were kind of, shaken by what was happening in the world and by the enormous energy that came out of this young group of dancers. Miriam Blecker and Anna Sokolow, Sophie Maslow, Edna Ocko, Fania Geltman, Edith Siegel, myself, most of them having been trained, the best ones having been trained in their companies. I think that's an important thing to understand. And this group presented a program which raised a huge storm. John Martin gave it, who was the important dance critic on the New York Times and who did a great deal to establish modern dance and to define the theories that modern dancers at that time were working on, he gave it a terrific review. So we all suddenly found ourselves kind of the young hopefuls of the modern dance, and we all were. I mean, I don't think any of us were older than 23, 24 at that time, if that, probably 20, 21, 22. This is mid-30s, this is 1935.
Right.
Many of the dancers who performed at the benefit had been trained by Hanya Holm, herself scrupulously non-political, in the Mary Wigmont School. They called themselves the New Dance Group.
It was a very interesting studio. It had classes every night. The first class was technique. The second class was group improvisation, in which they would take a theme and everybody in the class would improvise on that theme. And the theme, of course, was very often a revolutionary one. And then at the end, the last hour was political discussion. So it was very, very strongly politically oriented. I definitely would say that the entire influence was that of the Communist Party, that was their political outlook.
Was Jane politically active offstage?
I was close to the party for a while. I never was very active, and I never felt comfortable being active. I deliberately did not want to drain off time and energy in that direction because I felt that it would make my own dancing less good, and I would not be as good a dancer if I did. And I know I'm right as I look back on it. There was an enormous amount of naive, inartistic work in the dance. Theater is a little different because you can do a lot more with words. I mean, there was the wonderful Newsboy and some of the national groups, the German Workers Theater, and then there was a Lithuanian one. And there was the Artef. They could be much more direct in their approach. When this happened in the dance, either you had to become much more agitprop than any of us at this time were oriented towards. We thought of it in terms of doing good dances. We never thought that what we did would change the world. That was, we felt naive. What you could do is to dance on those themes which you felt strongly about, and you did have a point of view.
In the aftermath of the Depression, the nation experienced a broad upsurge in awareness of its democratic heritage. Following 1935, communists accordingly sought to Americanize their message. This change of tactics on the left probably found its best and most sincere expression in the work of idealistic young artists who came of age in the 30s.
We used folk material very consciously. I did a dance which became very famous, actually, and I've redone it last year in England, Harmonica Breakdown, which was a recording of Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, which I heard at one of the Spiritual to Swings program, and I did it in 38. Sophie did the Dust Bowl Ballads of Woody Guthrie. We were very, very much concerned with finding a vehicle that one could relate one's dancing to people through. I remember very consciously looking through American history and coming on the figure of Molly Pitcher, who had, during the American Civil War, taken her husband had been wounded, and she jumped into the breach and fired the gun. This was part of a very conscious direction taken by all of us to make our dance accessible to as large a non-dance audience as possible with a political orientation.
Audiences did grow. So did the number of small dance and drama groups.
You had the theater union, you had the group theater, you had the group theater studio. you had the Federal Theater, and the Federal Theater, of course, was the one that produced some of the greatest directors, artists, actors, Orson Welles, John Houseman, people like that. It was a period of great economic and political unrest, because we were right in the middle of the Depression, and the country was up in arms, but it was reflected in many of the plays that were done, like A Third of a Nation, a Living Newspaper, and all of the plays that had a lot of social content and social challenge, and it was a period of great social upheaval, and out of it came tremendous creativity and beauty, great friendships. It was a wonderful period, even though we were all half starving to death, because the salaries on the Federal Theater, as you probably know, were, I think, were $23.86 a week. They had what they called a pool. And when you were not working in some specific production, you went to the pool. But there you took fencing lessons and speech lessons, or any classes you wished to take. And then when a production was going to be cast, then they would take people from the pool and read an audition and so on. But you always had at least a little bit of salary, you know, to keep you going.
The Federal Theater Project was formed in 1935 under the Works Progress Administration, the New Deal Work Relief Agency. By 1938, the WPA employed 3.5 million people at everything from dam building to modern dance.
The dancers that were employed in the Federal Dance Project were mostly the left-wing dancers. They came, a lot of them, from the New Dance Group. The top-notch choreographers, Martha would have nothing to do with it. Doris did move in, I think, and did some work for the Federal Dance Project. But the main person who did was Tamiris, Helen Tamiris. And she really stuck by the fort, and it was good for her.
And then the Federal Theater died. They killed it on a rider on another bill. And we had mock funerals, you know, all through Broadway. Midnight candle-lit demonstrations all through Broadway. It was devastating, because all that wonderful creative work, not just in theater, but in art and in dancing and in painting, it had supported the artists of the country.
The Federal Theater Project had also created stiff competition for many of the new independent groups. But most upset were those congressmen who felt that the project had been funding Stalin's propaganda. While most communists would not object to that, few people in the party, let alone in radical art circles, were in close touch with the Soviet leadership at this time.
It didn't occur to us to doubt Stalin in any way. When the Nazi-Soviet pact was signed, the point that everybody fully, I mean, and it did create a lot of waves, I'm going to tell you, but I remember sitting in on a meeting where people spoke in defense of it, saying that by doing it, Stalin was gaining time. He was creating a length of country so that it would take the Germans that much longer to get to the borders of the Soviet Union. That was how it was explained away. We didn't even believe the reports of Salisbury, who was a Moscow New York Times correspondent. He had a lot of things to say. People on the left felt that he was, or people in the circle I was moving in at the time, felt that he was an anti-Soviet in his sympathies, and therefore he was reporting it was gossip.
Looking back on a decade of politically engaged creativity amidst enormous suffering and upheaval, how did these women rate the movement's success?
I feel that the party at this period was one of the most important forces in the American scene. It was small, but it had a huge clout, and it influenced and pushed some of the most socially constructive issues of that period, so that there was enough mass support so that these socially beneficial moves were made legal. I mean, Roosevelt wouldn't have done what he did if he hadn't been in a position where he had to rescue the capitalist system.
And the New Deal didn't come out of Roosevelt. It came out of all the organizations that started in the 30s, like the Workers' Alliance and the Unemployed Councils. And they started the hunger marches, and they began to have big demonstrations at the Capitol, and this was the beginning of the New Deal. And it was also the basis for the CIO in 37. I don't think you could have conceived the CIO, a broad organization, without these Workers' Alliance, Unemployed Councils, and they had their own newspapers, their own culture, and the women had their own organization within those. I think women had a tremendous, the Workers' Alliance and Unemployed Council, the women were powerful. Education in the Workers' Alliance and the Unemployed Council was very important. You had all these masses of people that were just emerging out of cocoons of silence. As I say, they had a tremendous culture, music, they composed songs and poetry. When you have an uprising of any kind of oppressed people, you have great culture comes out of it.
Did these women feel discriminated against? At home, opinion was evenly divided, yes or no, as it was with most of the other women interviewed in this series. As for discrimination within the movement, reaction was, again, quite typically, a unanimous yes and no.
There were no sexual distinctions at all. Many women were organizers of their particular units. Not too many women were put up by the left to run. It was, you know, traditionally, of course, a masculine role.
The left did fight against discrimination in the workplace.
They did, not so much in terms of political positions as in terms of fighting for equal wages for women. Now, in the theater, this was not an issue because everybody got the same salary.
Do they think that artists should be politically involved?
All art, whether you're aware of it or not, is propaganda because you're giving a message of some kind, one way or another. Whether you're aware of it or not.
Art as a weapon in the class struggle? In certain world situations, yes. Definitely yes. I mean, I think artists should rally to fight against nuclear war. In that sense, if great posters are done, if poems are written, if plays are done, I think artists should be socially concerned in some way. Definitely. Not just live in little ivory towers.
Do they have a message for the grandchildren of the movement?
I believe very definitely, and I think a lot of other people do, our friends, that we are going through a stage now, the last stage of so-called capitalism, just like we went through the last stages of feudalism and so on way back. And if people, the young people, had that conviction or understanding that this is a stage and we're going to come to something better, that the people have to do it themselves, they have to be ready for it and do it, it would give them a feeling of what lies ahead.
Your lesson for today.
Yes, teacher! Yes, teacher!
Are you ready to hear what history has to say?
Yes,
I still
teacher.
Believe in
yes,
socialism.
Teacher.
I just haven't seen it work yet anywhere.
1776.
That's all.
As those history pages turn, we will see what we can learn.
You have been listening to The Militant Muse, the sixth and final part of Grandma Was an Activist, a radio series on radical women in the 1930s, produced for WBAI-FM and the oral history of the American left at New York University's Tamamat Institute Library.
Don't sing out people's rights that way. They might believe in what you say. So stop your song. It's not polite. Pipe down before you start a fight.
Oral historians for the series, John Bloom, B. Leamish, and Ruth Prager. Project directors, Paul and Mary Jo Buell. Mix by Stephen Erickson.
To keep you sitting on your status quo.
We wish to thank the many interviewees who made this series possible. Special thanks to Priscilla Bachman, Mark Nason, David Paskin, and David Rapkin for research assistance and technical advice. Grandma Was an Activist was produced by Beth Friend and Charles Potter, Radio Arts Incorporated. This is Jill Eikenberry. Thank you for listening. Grandma Was an Activist was made possible by a grant from the New York Council for the Humanities, with additional support from the Community Funding Exchange, New York, New York.